Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite podcast, where editors of Managed Healthcare Executive chat with healthcare executives in the C-Suite and professionals. Our conversations are about the most important issues facing American healthcare today, such as its cost, effectiveness, delivery, organization, and its fairness. Listen in, learn a lot. Hi everyone, my name is Brianna Contreras and I'm Associate Editor of Managed Healthcare Executive. In this episode, I spoke with Dr. Maria Hernandez, founder and CEO of Impact for Health. Maria shared with me not only how healthcare inequities remain to be an issue in healthcare and what needs to be addressed, but she also shared the progress that has been made over time through awareness, conversations, and laws, especially due to the heightened awareness caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the tragic deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many more, which have now been over a year. Hello, Maria. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Breonna. How about yourself?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for joining me for an episode of Tuning the C-Suite podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here.
All right. So for the first question, if you can just introduce yourself and your role and the mission of Impact for Health.
Absolutely. So Impact for Health is based out in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area. And our mission is to advance innovations that support health equity. We are a small but mighty firm, and we work with a lot of health systems right now to support defining their health equity strategy, helping them to assess where they are in their journey, making recommendations for them about what they can do, and then sometimes even implementing those recommendations. They tend to fall in a couple of categories. It's training or looking at their data in very different ways. But right now, as you can imagine, with the pandemic, we really have entered a phase into our work that's just 16-hour days, because so many organizations are really trying to advance their strategy. And I have the privilege of being part of the team that organizes all of that and sets it up for success.
Oh, wonderful. Great to hear. So for the discussion today, we'll be talking about how healthcare inequities in America remain to be a major public health crisis, and what lawmakers and healthcare networks need to do to improve the situation. So for my first question, who is most affected by health inequities nationwide, and how are they affected? And then if you can give me some examples, and then lastly, why? So more of a who, why, and how kind of question.
Yeah, sure. I think it's fair to say that we know health inequities have existed for over 100 years. We've studied it. We've recognized that it's a problem. I think the pandemic made it that much clearer that African-American communities, Latino communities, other communities where English is not the dominant language have all suffered enormously. Those particular populations have been in the literature for a long time. Why it's happened, I think we have to be mindful that, medicine as a sector, the healthcare sector, has its roots in the same origins of the nation as a whole. And there's a lot of data to look at how healthcare participated in some of the most biased and racist activities in our country. One of the things that I think is super interesting here is we still today have remnants of that biased approach to medicine. We know, for example, that Blacks do not receive the same amount of pain medication that others receive. And I have to tell you that some of the early trials of procedures for women and OBGYN were done on female slaves, and they were done without anesthesia, and they were done without medication. And the American Medical Association has recently published its strategy around health equity, and its first few pages are about accepting those early roots of how the American Medical Association started. But I will say, We've known about these for a long time, and I think the pandemic simply made it that much clearer that they existed. And so we're now in that process of identifying what to do. And I think there's a lot of different things that people are trying to do. It ranges from first just looking at the data. What is the data telling us about the experience of these different communities inside our healthcare system? Second, how do we train everyone to understand what culturally effective or culturally responsive care really looks like? And last but not least is understanding that we all have unconscious bias. Doesn't matter how much education you've got, how much training you've got, it's just part of the human condition. And I think those are the responses that people are now really focused on.
Definitely. Thank you. Now, this kind of piggybacks off of what you just said about how the pandemic really spotlighted a lot of these inequities. So I guess if you can maybe just dig a little deeper as to how it did, or what maybe some examples, what inequities?
Sure. So we know, for example, that Latino men were dying from COVID-19 at its height at twice, if not, I think almost three times the rate of whites. And for African-Americans, it was equally high, like 2.5 times as much. And part of the question that we had to ask ourselves is, why is this happening?
Right.
Well, it has to do with the fact that we're part of a whole range of systemic biases in our country. The frontline worker is much more likely to be a person of color and have limited access to care. And they're also more likely to live in really different housing conditions. So multifamily housing is, as you can imagine, a place where a lot of people are in and out during the day. And if they're all going to their frontline jobs, they're the ones getting the most exposed to this virus. And it's not until you take into consideration those factors that you begin to say, so what do we do differently for that particular community? And what we do differently for that community is more work. It takes a concerted effort. It takes planning. It takes relationships in those communities. And frankly, healthcare has not necessarily built those relationships up in a really consistent way. And so we're learning the hard lesson that healthcare doesn't happen inside the four walls of a hospital. It happens in combination with all of those wonderful community partners that now we're really having to rely upon, whether it's a nonprofit that works in those communities or a faith-based organization that's part of the community. That's what we had to painfully learn here in the pandemic. And if I can find any silver lining to this tragedy, it's that the lesson was learned. I'm seeing a lot more effort in this regard. And that is what's necessary to reach those specific communities.
Thank you. And like the pandemic, if you can share, you know, how, which is now over a year ago, how did the tragic killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and unfortunately, you know, many others, bring more awareness of the inequities that affect many groups? And have there been any changes since?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Breonna, because I think what happened is we had two really major events happen in our country at the same time that brought attention to the inequities, one in healthcare, one in the criminal justice system. And I think that because people saw this painful moment on TV, everyone seemed to feel real passionate about what to do. And so inside healthcare environments, I think you're seeing far more structured organizational response to bias, discrimination, certainly systemic racism, and so on. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement made it all the more important to address. We know in addition to there being health inequities, healthcare still suffers from a significant amount of bias in its own population of employees. So if you look at most healthcare systems, There's diversity, but it's not necessarily blended in with the leadership or the executive team. It tends to be quite focused and concentrated at the front lines. And I've never met, individuals, people of color who don't want to advance their career and don't understand the importance of being seen as potentially becoming an executive. So what's happening? Well, there's bias inside healthcare as well about our own community, our own staff. And I think both of those events really made for the perfect storm to actually say, we need to do something, not just about how we serve people of color, those disenfranchised, underserved communities, but we also need to look at ourselves and understand what are we doing internally that makes it so hard for people of color, even in some environments, women, to navigate to those C-suite opportunities. And the systemic bias, unconscious bias, those are trainings that we're doing a lot of work in right now, because I think this situation has really created that energy and that focus to actually get something done.
Great to hear. Now to kind of add on to the changes, what new laws were passed to improve health equity, and have they been successful?
Yeah, so I think that it's important for the audience to know that there is a huge initiative on its way. It's called the Health Equity and Accountability Act of 2020. It just started the entire sausage making process of laws in the United States. And if you look that up, it really has simply been introduced. That means that there's a lot more that it needs to go through in order to be passed as a law. But if you look at the list of activities that are going to be required as a part of this action, this particular act, it's going to focus on the kind of data that hospitals need to look at in order to track inequities. It's going to look at standards of care to meet the underserved communities in a neighborhood. There's many different elements to this. And so it's not passed. It's basically just getting started. And I'd say that's the right thing to look for. That's the right thing to be doing. It might take almost 5 to 6 years before that gets done. So what's happening in between is that you're seeing different states look at what they can do as well. So here in California, for example, just last year, legislation was passed that all OBGYN physicians need to take an unconscious bias course. And again, that's because, unfortunately, maternal health in this country is such that women are at the risk of dying. Black women are at the risk of dying at 2.5 times the rate of others. That approaches third world countries. And so it's completely unacceptable because most of those deaths are preventable. So to begin to address that, I think that this was the right thing to do, that California, one of the larger, more populous states, is saying, what if we start to really require this kind of training? So I think we're going to see more of that. Probably the other legislation that isn't quite legislation, but it seems to be seen as a standard that healthcare is trying to address, is the culturally and linguistically appropriate services standards, or CLASS. Those were announced by the Department of U.S. Health and Human Services way back in 2000. And, there were a multitude of reactions to that. One of them is that translation services are more common. They're still not required by federal law. Some states do, but that was one of the big heavy lifts inside those standards. Another was looking at culturally competent care as a type of training that people needed to engage in. The list is really great, and I'm super excited that that's been around for so long. Unfortunately, not everyone is practicing all of those standards. And again, that's one of the things that we try to come in and do and ask, are you aware that these are some of the things that you could be doing to reach those communities that you are most concerned about? So I think we're starting to see more energy around, you know, mandating these practices. I think that's fine. I would love to see, however, that hospitals and, you know, federally qualified health clinics and, you know, faith-based nonprofits that serve communities, I'd hope that they would feel that they themselves need to help, you know, further this work, and that they themselves can hold on to those standards for their own benefit and for the benefit of the community, and not have to wait for a law to pass. But certainly does help that we have something on the books that potentially could really organize this work. And we need to see how far this goes. I think that the Biden administration is definitely speaking a lot about health equity, and they too are looking at, again, how to enhance some of the standards that would really be a step in the right direction.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. For my next question, why are equity and inclusion vital to improving healthcare outcomes for diverse people, which I know we touched on a bit, but I guess if you could dig a little deeper.
Yeah, so I think there's no hospital in our country that would ever say we provide quality of care for some. I think every hospital in our country says we want to provide the best possible care for all. And if that's your mission, then you need to care about health equity, because you can't have quality of care if only a few people really are served and their needs are met in your four walls. So when we think about health equity, remember, that's just simply saying everyone has a fair and just opportunity to achieve their optimal health. That means that whether they speak English or not doesn't matter. If they're rich or poor doesn't matter. The color of their skin doesn't matter. All of these factors are not to be considered. They just need the best quality of care, and they should be able to achieve the best health possible. Inequities are those differences that we see in the data. I gave you two examples, obviously the pandemic, maternal health, diabetes, heart disease. We know that different populations have very different outcomes, and a lot of those outcomes are driven by what's avoidable or unfair or unjust. Access to care in this country is probably, you know, the number one factor. The other is your zip code, which is determined, you know, of course, access, but it also determines what kind of food you eat, what kind of housing you have, what kind of air you breathe. And it's one of the reasons why we try to emphasize to our clients that their partnerships with different community groups are really their best way to avoid those inequities. So I think we need to accept that these are real, that they are things that we should be able to agree to interact on, to support, to collaborate with others to address. And you're seeing some wonderful examples of that in different health systems. Let me just mention one as an example, ProMedica, which is a large system up in Ohio. If you look at what they did a few years ago, they recognized that food insecurity is one of their social determinants of health. And they chose to really organize a lot of their outreach effort in the community around how to address that. You know, of course, often you feel like, wow, we're going to take on the world in order to solve these massive problems. But through these strategic partnerships, it wasn't just the health system alone. It was a number of different organizations that came together to address health disparities that are rooted in food insecurity. So I think we have some examples to look to provide people an opportunity to be inspired, of course, and then to borrow those best practices and try to implement those in their own system.
Wonderful, thank you so much. Now, why do healthcare staff need to be more diverse?
So there's lots of data that says when people see others who are like themselves, they are more likely to feel comfortable and relaxed, and they're more likely to engage. And I tell this story as an example because it's something I saw in my own family About 10 years ago, my dad was facing his first battle with cancer, and he was about to be wheeled into the surgery unit. And we stopped in the hallway with him, and we're speaking Spanish. We're saying, you know, we're going to be there for you, Dad. And all of a sudden, he puts up his hand and says, "Stop speaking Spanish. They're going to think I'm stupid, and they're not going to help me." And it was such a moment for us. And I was so taken by it because my dad did speak English. It wasn't, you know, the best of English, but he did know how to communicate. And he also had me, my brother's a physician, my other brother at that time, he was serving in California state government. And so he had a lot of knowledge about what to do, how to help my dad. And yet he's afraid that just because he speaks this other language, that people are going to treat him differently. So I saw him relax and feel so much more at ease when he found out that the post-surgery team had some nurses that spoke Spanish and were able to communicate with him in his recovery. And I think about that a lot every day because I think about how many families don't have those resources or don't have the ability to be someone's advocate. And so the experience of having someone in the room that looks like you, that speaks your language, that relates to you, is absolutely essential to create that sense of comfort. So hospitals need to increase the diversity of staff at all levels. And again, unfortunately, you know, at least in California, we are 39% Latino, and I believe only 6% of nurses in California are Latina. So it's a big gap, and we know that we need to work on that on a number of levels beyond just in healthcare, of course, in the education system and so on. Yeah,
of course. And thank you for sharing that story. I was actually going to ask if you, you know, had any personal experiences, you know, dealing with this, because I mean, I assume just from your last name that you, that, you know, you were also of the Latina community, but if you have any other, you know, personal experiences of your own, you know, just being in healthcare and a CEO yourself, you know, in the healthcare industry, you know, what you've seen or maybe some changes that you've wanted to make yourself.
Well, I grew up in an era when I was my mom and dad's translator for their healthcare appointments. I remember being a very little girl and having to say things that I don't think little kids should have to say. And certainly we're trying not to do that. It still happens in some environments, of course. And so I would say that, you know, we can't approach this particular problem as if it's going to be just in healthcare's realm to solve. It really is a systemic issue. It's education, it's our communities, it's how we structure so many different parts of the way the US provides care to people. And, you know, today we're not talking about all of those other policies about healthcare for all or Medicare for all. What I can say is this, I think that we are learning more and more each day how much your zip code influences your life. And the fact that we know that means we need to act on it. And I think healthcare is waking up to that reality because of the pandemic. So I'm very optimistic. I have a lot of really high expectations about what will come from this. But I think, you know, the bias that I've experienced, that my family has experienced, it's very real, and I think we're all becoming much more aware of the microaggressions, the micro inequities that people need to overcome in order to navigate their career, their lives. I would just say my you know, greatest reward is being able to see the progress of some of this work and to be able to encourage the next generation that's coming behind me that is going to rock this world with so much more energy and focus on this. I was just teaching a course of residents at a system, and we were talking about unconscious bias and how it shows up in daily practice. And I asked the group, you know, how many of you had an opportunity to talk about unconscious bias in medical school? And I was so thrilled that about half of the class raised their hand. So what does that tell us? It says, you know, even as early as medical school, we're beginning to introduce these ideas and hopefully make an impact. And number two, as I see those young faces and the faces of the physicians that are part of this system, they're going to have some pretty interesting conversations in the hallway about what bias looks like, what are different experiences that people are having. And I think that next generation is going to call in, not just call out, but I think they're going to call in their colleagues and say, let's try to be more inclusive. Let's try to be more mindful of what this patient might need from a cultural standpoint. And so that gives me a lot of hope. And I'm just super excited to be part of that journey.
Oh, that's wonderful. And how amazing, like you said, that students were sharing, you know, their bias experiences, and you're sharing it at such a crucial time, you know, in medical school. So more people are stepping in more aware than they have been possibly in the past. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, it is.
And then lastly, my last question for you, what can healthcare networks do to improve equity and inclusion for staff and patients?
So the number one thing that we need to start off with is looking at the data. We cannot just be comfortable saying, oh, on average, our patients experience our hospital in a very positive way. We need to now start looking at data through those demographic groupings that are so important. So it's race, ethnicity, language preference, and I'm going to add to that sexual orientation and gender identity. Those are major groups of demographic information that we need to look at. And it's hard to do, believe it or not, as much as we think that all this data is collected on us inside our medical records, not all hospitals have started to actually ask those questions of people as they come in for care. And so it's a journey now to try and catch up and collect that data on the patients that are being seen. So that's number one. I think the second is that someone has to be responsible for looking at that data. I can't tell you how often we find out that a hospital might have that data available, but no one's asking about it, right? And so, you know, Peter Drucker once said, if it isn't being measured, it's not being managed. My new thing is, if no one's asking, no one's even asking to measure it, we're in trouble, right? So that energy, that focus on asking those tough questions. How are we doing with those different communities that we serve? How do they experience our facility, our staff, our services? Those are the tough questions that have to start actually even at the board level. The boards of hospitals need to be able to hold the C-suite accountable to those metrics and that information, and to really get out in the community and talk to people about what can we do to improve? How can we make this better? So there's plenty of activity out there now that I think is headed in the right direction. But I would say those two are the primary places to start. It's the data, it's what you know about that experience, and making sure you're responding to the communities with feedback and testing the waters with them about what you're going to try and do, and not try to do it in a vacuum. So having a health equity council formed with community members is often a good way to hear that voice at the table. So those are a few things that I would like to see happen consistently.
Thank you. So yeah, that's actually all I had for you. But if there's anything else, Maria, that you'd like to share with our listeners that you think is really important to get out.
You know, the only other thing I'd share, it's something that I'm being asked in different interviews about what patients can do, right? So if you're a person of color and you're about to go in to see your physician, what should you try to manage and look out for? One of the interesting statistics that I read along the way is that physicians interrupt their patients 18 seconds into their appointment. And that might not be hard for someone who's, say, really comfortable speaking English, or someone who doesn't have some anxiety about, you know, the authority figure that they're working with in their patient experience. So I talk a lot about having a patient advocate with you, someone who's going to be there to support you during your appointment, a family member, a trusted friend, someone who knows what your concerns are and who can watch the interaction and support you in making sure that you're getting your needs met, because it can be sometimes really intimidating or there's other factors at play. The person might be really anxious, and having someone there that they are comfortable sharing the information with is key. So bring your own patient advocate. I think that's important for families of color to know.
Yeah. That's awesome. And that should be a hashtag. Bring your advocate. Bring a patient.
There you go. Bring your own advocate. There you go.
That's awesome. But Maria, thank you so much for this conversation and meeting with me. You know, you not only educated myself a lot more on a lot of these issues, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners. So again, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Brianna. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Tuning Into the C-Suite Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and follow Managed Healthcare Executive on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. For more information on Managed Healthcare Executive, visit our website at www.managedhealthcareexecutive.com.